We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this 31st day of January 2012. Yes, the last day of January. Hard to believe we're already well down the path for 2012. We've got a big show today. So in the studio, this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and with me is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill, and good morning, listeners.
So in the show today, we will be speaking to Kyle Lovett. Kyle Lovett is a research editor and author for A Voice for Men in the USA, and he has a blog, Fraud in Australia's Plan to Reduce Violence Against Women. So that will be very interesting to hear what research he has done. Kyle is an excellent researcher and blogger, and has a very interesting personal story as well. So we'll look forward to speaking to Kyle. And later on, we'll be speaking to Barbara Kay, who is a columnist with the National Post in Canada. And she's written a recent article called The Awkward Truth About Spousal Abuse. And we're going to be introducing a new feature today. We've asked Barbara and Kyle if they would like to select some suitable music to go with their interview. So we'll be asking them about that, playing their songs, hopefully, and getting their story. So that's for the show for this week. Before we get on with our interviews, as usual, there are a few items in the news that have caught our eye. And I suppose the first one that that I was particularly interested in there was relates to feminism. And there was a recent article by Anne Summers, who is a long-term old-school feminist. And she wrote an opinion piece in last week's Sunday Age in which she defined the principle of feminism as boiling down to the fundamental principle of a woman's ability to be independent. But then she violated her own creed because essential to being independent is being free to think and believe what we wish. Oppression begins with control over the mind. And what does Anne Summers say about that? She believes that any woman that doesn't support the right for women to abort their children is definitely not a feminist.
But isn't that control over their bodies?
Precisely. So it's the old school feminism, and interestingly, the article
and independence. That sorry to interrupt, yeah. Bill, but I mean just what you're saying, independence. So I mean, but what they're basically a woman's. So it's got nothing to do with being a good partner in a marriage or in a relationship. It's completely to do with the woman being out on her own and being independent of men, presumably, and other women. It would appear to me it's to that is just complete and utter separatism. That's the word for that, which I don't think many people would agree that separatism is a particularly good thing. But do go on.
Yes, well, and that's I think that's a reason why the word itself is often being avoided now by young, particularly young women. They do not want to be associated with that type of thinking. And this has been set out in a letter to the or another article in the Herald Sun by Joanna Howe. She headed at Newsflash and dictating what one should think isn't feminism. Being against abortion doesn't disqualify a woman from being a feminist, argues Joanna Howe. She describes Anne Summers and the other old feminists as being feminist dinosaurs, and I think typical of what a lot of young women are saying now, that she says, I don't want to be a feminist if it's you who are defining what that is. Well, it's same appreciating that the good work that's been done by feminists from an earlier age, going back to the original writing perhaps by Germaine Greer in the Female Eunuch, where it's now possible for women to go into all sorts of things, sometimes I think to their detriment. They can now be frontline fighters in the army, for instance. But nevertheless, they can readily become lecturers at university, they can
become prime ministers,
become
premiers,
precisely.
They can be the queen of the Commonwealth, women, they can be whatever they want, really, in this day and age.
So I think there's a lot to be grateful for, that half of society is taking its place and doing all those things. But with this old-style feminists are continuing to or have taken it one step too far, in my opinion, and also in the opinion of these young these young women, Joanna Howe, and there was another article in the Herald along a similar line.
And me too, Bill. I'm with you.
Yep. In fact, you know, at one stage I would have called myself a feminist, but
I would never have gone that far personally.
But not to this mind control that's going on now, and as I say, the use of the very word feminist is now in decline, and you very rarely hear people talk about it. They sometimes will refer to the F word rather than meaning feminists, rather than actually to spell out the word.
Well, it's a discredited dogma. I mean, realistically, men and women are equal parts of the human race and are equally important in the human race. But this idea of separatism is not helpful, is not useful, and anybody with half a brain can see that, be they man or woman.
Yes, Joanna Howe, who wrote this article, is a Rhodes Scholar and a law lecturer at the University of Adelaide, and she says that, unlike Anne Summers, she knows that intrinsic to her feminism is the right for women to come to these opinions themselves. She says, as a young woman, her biggest personal battles are knowing how to balance work and family, equally divide household work with her husband, and fully pursue the aspirations she has for her career. But she hopes the legacy of the generation of feminists will be that young women are allowed to grow up as part of a movement that respects their intellectual independence. And her biggest dream, which I think we would all share in this dream, is that her one-year-old daughter, the young children coming through today, young female children, can grow up to be proud of their womanhood, secure in their right to achieve all that she would desire, and confident in her autonomy to believe what she wants to believe. And she says, I don't think anyone, feminist or otherwise, has a right to dictate this to her.
Well, it's completely hypocritical, isn't it, really, to say that what sets a feminist apart is their right to basically decide their own, their own mind, and then here she is trying to dictate what feminism is and saying that all the other women should get on. I mean, that's just hypocrisy. That's just plain and simple.
Yes, so, look, it's good to see that there has been such reaction to Anne Summers' piece. And it's, as I say, there's been articles in the Sun in Melbourne, also in the Sydney Morning Herald, and along similar themes, that the young women don't want to be dictated to. They don't want to be associated with feminism if it means what Anne Summers dictates it means, and others of the old school early feminist beliefs.
Yeah, it's a discredited dogma, and to quote Tony Abbott, they should just move on.
Okay, so...
wonder if that'll incite a riot at Parliament House. I doubt it. I've got one here. In last Friday's Daily Telegraph, under the heading Mum's Hate Campaign, Joanne Fife Yeomans has written, a mother has lost custody of her two young daughters after she conducted an obsessive campaign against their new stepmother. Family Court Judge Justice Peter Young said he suspected it was the mother who painted bitch on the woman's house and wrote "Die, Dad haters" on her own car in felt-tip pen, and then sought to blame the stepmother. The judge said the sisters, aged 10 and 7, would be better off living with their father and his new wife because their mother would not likely change. He ordered an end to the shared custody, which had been going on for more than 5 years, and said the two girls should live full-time with their father. So there you go. That's a mum going berserk and doing ridiculous things. I don't know, obsessed jealousy, who knows? Who knows what motivated her, but it's a sad story for the children.
It is, it does give some level of hope, because this is Justice Young has said that he found there was a greater level of responsive behaviour and conduct in the father than in the mother. And this is something that is often referred to as the friendly parent approach, where some parents will sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, make it painfully clear that they're not supporting the children or child or children spending time with the other parent. Now, this, as I say, this can be quite subtle, but Justice Young won't have any of this if there's a flouting of the orders, and he thinks that one of the parents is capable of complying with the orders much better than the other, he's inclined to make orders accordingly. So in this case, the judge rejected the somewhat bizarre claims of the mother, and which included even taking the stepmother to court with criminal charges, which were all dismissed, in this case he's seen that the best approach is that offered by the father and the stepmother. And so from now on, the mother will see the children on alternate weekends, birthdays and during school holidays. So it's, a lot of fathers have had to live with this for a long time without being the unfriendly parent.
It's just a sad outcome for the kids, no matter how you cut it. It's not good for the kids. I mean, having either parent excluded from their lives or marginalised in their lives is not good for the kids. You know, all of the studies show that one.
Mm. So that was an article in the Telegraph from Janet Fife-Yeomans. I've got another one here, which is in relation to our old friend Jennifer McIntosh.
What's Jen been doing?
This is described as a newspaper story that you just couldn't invent. In the Sydney Morning Herald, it actually goes back to December. Jennifer McIntosh came up with the view that spending time away from home for babies and any child under two is a very bad thing. Now, the comment on this article is, who was aware that babies and under 2-year-olds had such a good memory that they would be adversely affected the following week or even later in life? Of course, he's cynically saying, sardonically saying, perhaps that all babies know immediately from the day they're born which house is a home, which you'd have to say is a lot of rot. Jennifer McIntosh shields herself from derision by using the Australian Association for Infant Mental Health as her conduit to get her message across. She passes the bullets, they pull the trigger. Yes. So the Australian Association for Infant Mental Health, in their guidelines, which have gone to the family court, I might add, for protecting the very young child's sense of comfort and security, is quoted as saying that prior to the age of 2 years, overnight time away from the primary caregiver should be avoided unless necessary, whatever that means. Separated parents should not share custody of babies or toddlers under two, according to these guidelines. So does this association suggest prohibiting 2-week-long holidays or visits to friends for the weekend? I mean, that's away from the family home. What about spending time with the grandparents? Is that deemed too destabilising for the child as well? This is madness when put into the context of a married couple, and it makes equal nonsense when put in the context of a separating couple. Yeah. The one the child needs is consistency, and that includes seeing it in all its manifestations, each parent. They need to have consistency with both parents. To pervert that consistency into meaning a straitjacket of never leaving home under any circumstances is really just too silly for words.
It is. It's horrifying, and it's denying the child experiences out in the world that would, normal experiences, which, may not all be pleasant and may not all be positive, but they're all part of growing a child's basically ability to cope in society. I mean, the more isolated they are, the more isolated they'll be when they grow up, and that's really not desirable at all.
Yes, I mean, look from a baby through a baby's eyes. How are separated parents any different from married parents? Is a child best interest to discriminate between the parents at that very young age under two?
Of course not. A child, as long as it has a relationship, if the child doesn't know any better, if that's what's happened to it at an early, if the separation happened at an early age, then the child really doesn't know any better. And as long as it has a meaningful relationship with both parents, surely that's the best you can hope for.
Well, perhaps one of the problems here is that that spinsters have an idealised view of motherhood. They see the cuddly little child and it's all soft and snuggly, and they are not thinking of the truth of the matter, which is that looking after children can sometimes involve unrelented screaming, sleepless nights,
shitting,
vomiting, diarrhoea, falling over, taking out the dirty laundry,
banging their head on the coffee table.
Yep.
All sorts of horrible things.
At those times, you've got to admit, the kids are a definite pain.
Dirty handprints on the wall.
All the rest of it. And mothers, like everyone else, look forward to some relief and a bit of a break from them. So if they can be persuaded that the best idea is to share custody with the natural father, surely it's going to keep everyone more sane, more balanced.
Yeah, you'd.
So Jennifer McIntosh's recommendations on infant custody for children under two really just take you nowhere.
Yeah, leave a lot to be desired.
Even if we were to assume that she was the world's foremost clinical psychologist, which is a bit of a stretch, and she's clearly not that, you'd have to shoot her down on the lack of her numerical skills. You really can't take seriously data based on a sample of just 258 children in less than 200 families and over a period of 4 years. To be taken seriously, she would have to have assembled at least 1,000 families and studied material from 7 to 10 years. But
come up with something sensible. You know, yeah. That's not even sensible. I mean, and that goes against all the other research. You know, that's just not sensible. Not credible. Sorry.
Yep. So
sorry, Jen. You blew it.
Her articles and her apostle on all this under children under two has fortunately come under some critical eyes. Those in particular of Yuri Ochomides, who is based in Australia, and Professor Warshak, who has been a guest on this program. And Professor Warshak is one that does have an international reputation in this field that poor old Jen McIntosh is trying to break into.
Put it down as black, extremely black comedy.
Yes.
with not much entertainment value. I have another one here. This appeared in last Friday's Telegraph as well. This is to do with the Darcy Freeman tragedy, the little girl who was thrown off the bridge in Melbourne and whose father is now incarcerated due to that. The heading is Darcy's mum to sue over bridge. Katie Bice has written, the mother of Darcy Freeman, the child thrown from Melbourne's Westgate Bridge by her father, is suing the Victorian Roads Authority, saying barriers could have saved her child's life. Peter Barnes said Vic Roads continually ignored advice to install anti-jump fencing. I mean, I think she's just after a big payout, and you really can't imagine that would have stopped the father from his disgraceful, horrifying action of throwing his daughter off the bridge to her death. But I guess Ms. Barnes is... was traumatized. She has, the article goes on to say, she has since suffered post-traumatic stress disorder and supports her two sons who witnessed their sister's death. In a heartbreaking victim impact statement, Ms. Barnes said she did not expect time to heal her wounds. Not a day goes by where I do not constantly think of Darcy, where I don't miss her and wish with all my heart that she was with me, she said. Obviously, she will, and that she will be traumatized forever. I mean, how do you get over that one? And the ex-husband, it's languishing in jail, probably, you would hope, feeling horrible remorse and thinking the same kind of things. But should she be compensated? You're a lawyer, Bill. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that certainly sounds like trying to build up a case to get some financial compensation from the Victorian government, which is a sad state of affairs, but I guess it's the world we live in at the moment.
Yep.
And
well, it says here, details of her claim are being kept confidential after an application to the court by Ms. Barnes' lawyers. The court caps personal injury payouts, but it is believed claims like Ms. Barnes' can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, I mean, who pays that? The taxpayer, or, you know.
Yep, no doubt. But I guess for the father, it's a terrible thing that's happened. But, you know, look, I don't think there's any doubt in the world that he was not of sane mind when he took those actions. And you think that should have been taken into account. But, you know, rather than giving him a murder charge, and this sort of thing happens every day when women have been found to have killed their children. It's a terrible thing, but... there are all sorts of other issues there, and I've got a very strong feeling we haven't got the whole story on that matter, and maybe we never will.
Yeah.
So we might go to a short music break, and we'll be back soon with our first guest.
We could choose to dish.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this 31st day of January 2012, and that was a band called She Had from Ian's home country.
Yes, it is. That's from my, that's from the best of our, well, it's actually a track off the General Electric. Yeah, they're a great band, great live band. If you get a chance to see She Had, I recommend them.
And now our first guest, Kyle Lovett. Kyle has been studying, practicing and blogging about Zen Buddhism for the last 5 years, and he's just started to write about men's rights issues. Kyle works in the technology field in Washington, D.C. in the USA, and he has a wonderful 10-year-old son. He's also the blog master of The Reformed Buddhist. Kyle, good morning.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Well, thank you. Kyle, you're a prolific blogger and researcher. I feel I've only just scratching the surface in reading some of your material, but look, it's great to have you on the show this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's quite an honor you asked me to join you guys. I've really enjoyed the last couple of weeks listening to you all. Didn't even know you existed until a few weeks ago. So,
well, that's great.
In addition to my listening material.
Fantastic. And now, Kyle, you've been doing some work on the situation in Australia, and in particular this Australian project from 2009, A Time for Action, the National Council's Plan for Australia to Reduce Violence Against Women and Their Children. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about that, because from what I've read, it's fairly horrific.
Nope. Yeah, absolutely. The initial plan itself is about 200 pages long. It was put as part of the Labor Party's platform in 2007 before the Red government won election and took power. Shortly after he took power, he initiated the commission, which was 13 individuals of the council that were supposed to write this plan out that was part of their platform. And it was headed by two Australian politicians, I guess pretty prominent ones. One is Tanya Plibersek, who used to be the MP for the Status of Women.
Yes, she's recently been she's just recently been promoted, so they obviously like what she's doing.
And Jenny Macklin was the other one, who was the, she used to be the for the Department of Families MP. Is that what they call it? MP? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Yes. There seems to be a bit of delay, but look, we'll battle on. On the basis of, they were commissioned to prepare this this report, and it concerns me that they're very keen to quote figures, but then the figures seem to be distorted, and in some cases they're just straight out untrue.
Yeah, the report itself, when you start to read it, and I think most people, any person has looks at things in a logical manner, starts to see a very strong bias in the writing as it comes out, and much of what they write like you said, some of it are statistics that are mischaracterizations of the actual facts as they are. One of the most prominent ones being the one that they repeat over and over again, that 1 in 3 women will be victims of violence in their lifetime. But they preface it by saying that domestic violence against women is an ongoing problem that needs to be fixed. What they don't say is the 1 in 3 isn't actually 1 in 3 women are a victim of domestic violence. 1 in 3 is how many women have actually been a victim of violence of any kind by anyone. And for the same numbers, men actually are victims of violence far more than women, which are about the same for, here in the U.S. and the U.K. and Canada. It's about 29% is what the Bureau of Statistics said down there, while men showing about 41%. So throughout the plan, you'll see these kind of statistics where they're half-truths followed by a sentence that makes you think that it's related to the statistic above. Some of them are just outright disingenuous lies.
Yes, well even in this area, you'd like to be more accurate. 9% is the same as 1 in 3 is not really accurate, but and I think the other point you've picked up is that they've focused in on women over the age of 15, and I think there's a reason for that, isn't there?
Yeah. One of the things that, I think any man would be, or any father, would be very, I think, offended by the fact that the name of their plan is against violence against women and their children, using the possessive pronoun of their, as if fathers didn't exist in the life of their children. The whole point of it, and when you start reading through it, is that they come to a lot of generalized conclusions. We were going to get back to the child's part of the statistic number. I'm sorry. The number is actually higher because they leave out children under the age of 15. The whole point of protecting their children, they don't actually talk about child abuse at all in here, with the exception of children are victims of domestic violence when they witness violence within the home. But they don't actually talk about violence against children that occurs physical or emotional or neglect. And obviously one of the big reasons for that is that women are more violent or perpetrators of child abuse much more often than the fathers. Mm. Some of that can be attributed to the fact that obviously more women have custody of their children than the fathers because of the court system. But even taking the percentages back, it really evens out if you take into consideration the children under 15, which aren't even mentioned in this plan. The victims of domestic violence for men are much higher. And I know here in the U.S. And in Canada, domestic violence is perpetrated equally between men and women for the most part.
And is that accepted in the U.S. and Canada? Is that that situation where it's equally distributed, is that an accepted statistic, or do people, the feminists, still want to argue that point in America as well?
That's a very interesting point. I think the popular notion, or the one that that gets played up to a lot, is that there was like a Verizon commercial that was run. It's a big telephone company here, showing a man in the hallway was beating his wife and children, and we must stop domestic violence. And it's one of those things that goes ignored, but it's not something that has really been argued against. I mean, there haven't been a lot, except for some radical feminists and some other other groups that say, well, any violence against men must have been the act of self-defense, and it couldn't have actually been, a woman perpetrating violence against men. So it is something that is, it's generally accepted but kind of ignored, because here in the U.S. and in Canada, there's Violence Against Women Acts that are still in place that were passed into law in the 90s.
So it's accepted but excused sort of for various other reasons. Is that the situation in the U.S.?
Exactly, yeah. And in the U.S., and I'm sure, and from reading what happens in Australia, men tend to be far more the ones arrested when a domestic violence call is put out, especially in places where there are mandatory arrest policies. And I know in Australia there's a few states there that have mandatory arrest policies, as they do here. Although more often, now they're starting to go to dual arrest policies where they could see where the violence has been reciprocal between the partners. But most often men don't come forward, as they don't say, they were, if they were hit by their wife. A lot of them tend to stay in the background, or, they don't want to, it's a shame thing, or, they don't want people to laugh at them, or in many cases accuse them of being abusive, and that's happened quite often.
Yes, well, it seems to be even worse in Australia on that on getting the accurate figures, because I think the Australian government and the Australian Bureau of Statistics have now stopped collecting statistics on the sex of the offender.
For child abuse?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was in Australia. That started in 1996. There were two studies done. There were well-recognized academics that showed the past 10 years and the sex and relationship of the perpetrator to the act of the child abuse. And the statistics were very shocking. In 1997, there was another one that came out that reinforced the same number, which said about 40% of all child abuse happens by solely of the mother, and about 6 to 7% happens solely by the father. The other 45% are a combination of it's both parents in conjunction, or a parent and a step parent, and then about 8% are other. In 1997, somebody in either the Bureau of Statistics or the Bureau of Health and Welfare, or the Institute of Health and Welfare, made a, not a recommendation, but said that they will no longer be taking statistics based on the sex and perpetrator of child abuse unless it was sexual abuse.
Hmm.
While the states, at least seven of the states and territories still sent that information in and still carry it to this day. And in 2003, even in their internal papers, they stopped even publicly putting that information in there. And we had sent a letter to someone at the health and welfare office asking them why that was the case, and they said that the statistics were not reliable, that they couldn't rely that the statistics were correct. But they had no problem with any other statistics showing, so the, you know, the sex of the offender. And, of course, the UK, the US, and Canada have never had any problem, and still to this day, as part of their yearly reporting, put in the sex and relationship of the perpetrator of the child abuse, which are quite similar to those in Australia.
Yes, it just seems like they were getting the answers that they didn't want, the answers that they were coming through, and they were coming through in the figures by the sound of it. So,
sure. Yeah, and we have there are some emails that were out there that do kind of explain some of this, but I haven't been privy to release any of those. But there's certainly definitely something going on where they don't want this information. Somebody within the bureau, you know, one of the bureaus or some entity within the bureaus. Maybe this is speculation on my part, because obviously this kind of thing would undermine much of what this plan says, and a lot of what this plan says, and especially what they want to do, is very, very, very horrific stuff, very, very devastating stuff to men and fathers.
Yes, well, as you said, they allowed the figures to go through on sexual assault, and presumably that's one area where men would have a higher figure than the women, so that's the one that's been allowed through, but the others, they've blocked.
That's correct. That's correct. So it was kind of, it was disheartening to see that a study about protecting women and their children never actually addressed protecting the children, you know, and going through and looking at what they're proposing to do, which the framework has been signed off on. Obviously, I guess a lot of this needs to be put through Parliament, and in fact, some of the local states, I believe Victoria is one of them, are actually taking some of these initiatives up now at a you know, state level, and putting some of them to a vote this year, from what I understand.
Yes.
And it is pretty easy to see going through the stakeholders, who are the ones that put this report together, who do they have, you know, ties to, and the scary part is to see how much of an impact just a small percentage of some very, I don't know another word to put it, angry, very hateful people have been, had a lot of influence over what has gone into this report from back in, starting in 2004.
Yes, well, there seems to be a bigger agenda of trying to redress that what some women might regard as being oppressed for centuries by men. So now they seem to be wanting to swing the pendulum completely the other way, and it seems to be a broad approach, not just even on the domestic violence. It seems to be part of a bigger plan to put men back in their place, sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the plan, what the plan calls for is what they call gendered civil and criminal laws. They're specifically asking for any type of sexual or domestic laws or family court laws become gendered, which, looking through the Australian Legal Reform Commission report, which is about a 1,600-page document, which is complements their plan, it is putting a different onus of burden of proof is on the male in many of the cases to prove that he didn't commit abuse. It increases what they consider can be abuse that only men can commit. It gives police much, much broader powers to enter the residence. It asks for special courts to be set up that will also be given broader powers to enact what they call no-contact protection orders, and even uglier exclusion orders and orders that remove much of, I guess, in 2006 there was a family law passed there that tried to equal out the time between mothers and fathers in family court before Rudd came into government. I'm not sure the name of that program.
Mm. Yes, well, I think that situation is in Victoria at the moment, that it really just requires a phone call from a woman to the police to say that she's fearing violence, and they'll come and take the father away in handcuffs. And that seems to be all part of this National Council plan to really disempower, to attack men in this way. And as you say, you sort of can link it almost to the racist approach. It's a sexist, if not a racist approach, but also very bad for the community as a whole.
Absolutely. I mean, men have a hard enough time as it is coming forward when they are victims of domestic violence. In the situation that they're trying to obtain, it would kill any desire for a man to come forward to express that he's been domestic abused, because it basically disenfranchises him from any help, any protection from the state, based on the fact that they have said, well, these are gendered crimes, that a woman would only act violently in the cases of self-defense. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shaming language that goes into there. And, you know, even by the Bureau's report, 60,000 men a year, about one-third of domestic violence are male partners. It appears that it would be condemning about 60,000 men to a life of being abused or getting out and leaving their lives behind, maybe leaving the children in an abusive relationship, with their parent. I have to admit that it's rather disturbing to see, any kind of Western democracy passing laws like this.
Yes.
You don't think that a Western democracy that is based on idea of equality and equal protection under the law, that would segregate the laws, or even want to consider segregating the laws, to holding one set part of their population to one standard and holding the other population to another standard based on nothing more than hyperbole and anecdotal evidence, and never even asking male victims of domestic violence what their take on it, or even going to many of these organizations that are there already in Australia asking about the mixed violence.
Yes, and we've mentioned Victoria a couple of times. In New South Wales, I was horrified to see in a preamble to some legislation a sexist remark about domestic violence and men. Seems in this field, in the area of domestic violence, it's open slather to say what you like about men and get away with it. But I'm interested in one part of the plan particularly, which is a myth, and it's, like all myths, very hard to get rid of. The plan says that while a small proportion of men are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, the majority of people who experience this kind of violence are women in a home at the hands of men they know. Men are more likely to be the victims of violence from strangers and in public, so different strategies are required. Now, I think when you actually look at the figures, that's not even true, insofar as men being violence at strangers and in public.
No, that's not true, and it's also a lot of the wording, small proportion, overwhelming. Well, 33.6% of domestic violence victims, a small proportion, is 67%. Even if the figures are correct, which don't count children, are correct. Mm. There's no doubt that men are usually more violent towards other men, usually in their late teens and early 20s. But domestic violence is a good chunk of the violence that does occur, both between men and women.
And also, it should be pointed out that a lot of that violence is actually incited by women, men protecting women or men protecting a woman's reputation. That a lot of violence in pubs, etc., is men fighting over women.
Absolutely, yeah, same everywhere. A lot of guys end up getting in fist fights or even gun fights or stabbings because of a relationship or because of jealousy.
Or somebody insulted their girlfriend. Somebody said something to their girlfriend, so they stand up for their girlfriend and end up in a fight for her honor and
Kyle, I should mention the other voice you're hearing is Ian Purdy, who's another dad's on the air in the studio. So
I like to lob my little bit over the horizon every now and then when I think there's something that I can comment on. But I'm appreciating what you're saying, and you're making a lot of sense. And it needs to be said, and it needs to be pointed out. So do carry on.
Now, Kyle, in Australia, we also have the problem of people like who you've drawn attention to, Professor Michael Flood, who seems to be batting for the other side in this, that he comes up with some extraordinary definitions of what it is to be masculine in our society, pointing out that there's some sort of male privilege. I just wonder if you've got any comment on Professor Michael Flood's findings.
Well, Michael Flood, his name is shown throughout most of this, and he is quite aligned with the White Ribbon Foundation, which I'm sure you've heard of, and actually the chair of the National Council who put this together is Libby Lloyd, who is the founder of the White Ribbon Foundation. What Flood says is that there's constructs of what it means to be a man, and that this privilege that we have is means that men are automatically controlling and exhibit behaviors towards women that are violent and this part of the plan, this is where Flood comes in a lot. We need to redefine what masculinity is, and when you look at that notion of male privilege, and I think I put on a lot of the article about, what does it mean to be privileged when you're talking about between men and women in society? And when you look at the things like how long do men live compared to women, how many government programs do we have for men, how many offices of health do we have for men, how many men die on the workplace as compared to women, how many men die of suicide by their own hand or victims of homicide, how many men are in jail. At the short end of the stick, all of those are men, and none of these are obviously addressed by Michael Flood or any of the people on the council. And in fact, it's almost disturbing to see how marginalized the pain and suffering that men have, and it's just thrown out like it doesn't matter. But they still want to fix or change a man's behavior or social, the ways they interact with society, which they want to do by, one, men that are convicted of this expanded definition of what they would consider violence, such as things as the silent treatment, driving dangerously, swearing, which wouldn't occur to women. They would have them put through a program, and this program would entail them having to admit that they are violent and having to pay restitution and going through a big thing to get out. And the second is intermediate and elementary school, or I guess grade school programs for boys, what it is a respectful relationship and what it means to be masculine. And it's pretty sad how marginalized men are. And it's as if they are subhuman, as if they are not capable of feeling pain or suffering. It's quite horrific.
And it plays up to the myths. We do have the White Ribbon Campaign in Australia, and we have a number of what they call ambassadors. And I spoke to one of these leading lights, one of these ambassadors, and said to him, I asked him about the White Ribbon Campaign, and I said, why is it solely directed at violence of men against women? And he said, after scratching his beard for a while, I said, because I reckon about 97% of it, that's what the violence is. And I nearly fell over. But so the ambassadors are certainly not given much information or evidence in this in relation to the white domestic violence and what the real statistics are.
No, and there's actually several websites about these ambassadors out there, and they don't even pretend to come right out and lie about some statistics. I mean, they just some of these they're pulling out of the thin air. Yep. And it's very disturbing.
Well, that's why it's wonderful to have someone like yourself, Kyle Lovett, a research editor and author of At A Voice for Men, because, Kyle, you are getting the real figures out there, and I can assure you we are very grateful, and the fact that you're in America and looking at our figures is fantastic for us. We are very grateful, and I wish you you know, continued success in what you're doing. But Kyle, we've introduced a new segment in which we've asked our guests to pick a song, and I asked you, you've come up with a selection. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about it. I think it's a local band.
Yeah, local band for, it's near me in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a band named 17 Stories. It's a friend of mine who is actually in the men's and father's rights movement, who is pretty inspiring, and his band is very inspiring, and he's written a couple of men's or father's rights songs on a side project as well. But his band, the 17 Stories, has a very, I guess, classic Southern rock feel to it, and I really enjoyed it, so I thought I would give him props, especially this song, One Life, which is, I think, pretty positive, a kind of a positive message, and, you know, that we should take the advantage of what we have in our life and right now and right here.
Well, I'm sure our listeners... Yeah, look, our listeners will greatly enjoy hearing this song, and if people want to check up on some more from Jade Michael and his band 17 Stories, I think all the information is on his website, which is artistryagainstmisandry.com, artistryagainstmisandry.com. So, Kyle, once again, thank you for being on the program, and we'll take it out with this One Life by Jade Michael and his band 17 Stories. Thanks again for being on the program.
Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it.
You only get they grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you're ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this 31st day of January 2012. And that song we've just been listening to is called One Life by Jade Michael and his band 17 Stories from Nashville, Tennessee. That was the choice of Kyle Lovett. And now our next guest is someone we always look forward to talking to. And this is Barbara Kay. Barbara comes all the way from Canada, from Toronto in Canada, I think. And Barbara is...
Montreal.
Montreal. I'll get it right now. So we can spend half the interview speaking French, no doubt. But anyway, Barbara is a columnist for the National Post newspaper in Canada, and she's recently written an article, "The Awkward Truth About Spousal Abuse." Barbara, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Nice to be with you.
That's great, and so it's great to have you there. And so, Barbara, these feminists' great achievements in the 70s seem to have turned a bit sour as we head into the 2000s.
Well, yes. I think what happened with spousal abuse was the assumption was that as the skeletons came out of the closet, they would all be women. You know, I mean, it was the big news that the women's revolution brought forward was that spousal abuse had been something women did not talk about, and there were no shelters, and so as research started to be done on this issue, they expected that it would all be women that would be coming out of the closet. But in fact, what honest researchers were finding was that in terms of most spousal abuse, I'm not talking about the really extreme end, you know, battered women with limbs broken and showing up in hospitals or dead. I'm talking about 99% of spousal abuse, which is shoving, hitting, you know, even burning, stabbing, throwing things, all this kind of abuse, which is very unpleasant and disagreeable, is actually bidirectional. It's bilateral. It's women and men. It's initiated by both. It's perpetrated against each other. And this was unwelcome news to feminists.
Mm-hmm. And it's caught everybody unprepared because, similarly, I think you define the situation for men now as what it was for women all those years ago, that there are no shelters for men to go to.
Yes. What happened was the honest researchers were kind of set aside. And the media was not consulting them, and they were not asked to sit on task forces, and they were not asked to train law enforcement or police. They were kind of disappeared, you know, like in Argentina, how, you know, people would be suddenly disappeared and thrown out of airplanes. Well, that's practically what happened metaphorically to researchers who were actually presenting peer-reviewed community studies with control groups, you know, the usual scientifically valid kinds of studies were producing very unwelcome, from the feminist point of view, stuff. And so it just didn't make the news. Mm. And so this has been now decades. We're now into the third decade of research that keeps bringing up the same findings. And the average person, if they're not really into this subject, is not getting the message, and you still see politicians talking about how women are at risk and we have to find policies that will help women and children. Well, they do have to be helped. Women and children, of course, have to be helped. But men who are abused not only can't find shelters for themselves, they can't find funded counseling for themselves, but to me the saddest thing is that a man who sees his children being abused cannot take them with him to a shelter. A woman, if her children are being abused, or if she's being abused and fears for her children's safety, can take her children with her to a shelter, but a man cannot. So that's why most men who are abused do not leave the home. They feel they have to be there to protect their children.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's not even a matter of defending themselves. They have to defend their children. And yes, and so what you've talked about the honest researchers. What about the dishonest researchers putting material out?
Well, the dishonest researchers start with the ideology and they start with a conclusion that they've already committed themselves to. The conclusion is that only women are at risk. So then they have to find studies that bolster this risk. Where do they go for studies, or what kind of studies do they produce? Well, some of them, this is known to happen, do the honest research, and then they simply sequester the stuff they don't like and put forth. So they'll say something like, one in three women has a chance of being abused in her lifetime. Well, that's an inflated statistic, but even if we're true, what they leave out is that one in four men has a chance of being abused in his lifetime. So what's the good of the one statistic without the other? Or they'll do studies that are guilty of selection bias. I have seen studies, or so-called studies, that are basically interviews with women in women's shelters. Now, this is what's called selection bias. You are interviewing a group of people who are in a place because they have already or claim to have suffered domestic violence. So if you ask them their views, well, you're going to get one kind of an answer. These are not community studies. But the thing about the media is, they see the word study, they never, or I shouldn't say never, but they often do not ask the person who presents them with the study. They won't say, how many people were in this study? Where were they chosen from? Were they volunteers, or were they randomly selected from the community? All these things, the methodology of a study is extremely important. So when the honest researchers present their findings, you can be sure that they have been peer-reviewed and that their methodology is correct. Then you move into the field of meta-studies. And meta-studies are studies that analyze all the previous studies or all the studies that are in that domain. And then they analyze the findings, the methodology, and all that sort of stuff. And if they come to the same conclusion, well, my goodness, we're dealing with settled science here, Bill.
Yes.
And 90% of the media don't have a clue.
Yes, well, it's not such a sexy headline, is it? And statistics
no.
statistics can be very boring and very dry. If you go to all that trouble that you were saying that you should go to, so it's much easier to go along with a myth. And of course, a myth is very hard to eradicate.
And then, of course, Bill, there's what the studies don't even attempt to put forward. Nobody wants to hear about child abuse and who's committing it. I know for a fact that in schools they have programs where teachers are educated to ferret out facts about abuse that their children may have witnessed, from their parents or that they suffered at home. But the material that the teachers are given is only instruction on how to elicit answers that give the right answers. In other words, is your father abusive to your mother, or do you see violence? Is your father beating up on your mother?
Yeah. When did you stop? That's the classic question. When did you stop beating your
exactly,
wife?
Exactly. Exactly. Or does your father hurt you? But they never ask, has your mother been abusive to your father? They never ask, is your mother abusive to you? Now, this goes on in the schools all the time. It also goes on in hospitals, Bill. I don't know about in Australia, but here, for example, in Canada, there are many hospitals and health centers where girls are routinely, let's say they come in with whatever, a high fever, or they come in with a broken ankle. It doesn't matter what they come into the hospital with. As part of the protocol for admitting them, they are routinely asked if they have suffered any form of sexual abuse. Now, we know that under the age of adolescence, boys are subject to just as much sexual abuse as girls, and about 20% of it is at the hands of women. But they are not questioned. They aren't, because nobody cares.
Yes, well, regrettably, I think it's the same situation in Australia. It seems like it's a worldwide epidemic, worldwide problem. But what do you think the understanding is in Canada? Is there an understanding that it is bilateral, the domestic violence, or is it people still think it's all women?
It is amongst people in the know, but if you asked the average person who reads the daily newspapers, I don't flatter myself that I'm anybody special here, but I can tell you that in Canada, I don't know of more than a handful of other media writers who are A, interested in this subject at all, and B, who actually feel that it's an important thing to get the truth out about the real figures, the real statistics. There's one or two, there are other, you know, writers in the media that will tell the truth if it comes up as a story, as a news story, but they don't follow it. Most people do not follow this as a regular subject. So I have many people who tell me, you know, until I read your articles, I had no idea this was the case. So I'm just sort of incredulous that an entire group of people can be, you know, taken for granted as they're ignored, that their pain and suffering is ignored simply because they're the wrong sex. It reminds me of what's going on in these cultures where women's pain and suffering is ignored because they're the wrong sex over there. Mm. It's almost like the world is split in two. Mm. You know, cultures where women are nobodies and cultures where men are nobodies.
Yes, I think we've perhaps swung the pendulum too far. Do you get any resistance from your articles and your approach to this?
I'm sorry. Are you
getting any resistance? I mean, have the feminist sisterhood taken a set against you for talking like this?
You know what? In the beginning, when I first started to write about this, I used to get feedback. People very angry. Feminists, yes, they don't like me. After a while, they started to sort of write me off as a crank, and I think they pretty well ignore me because when we do engage in discussions or when I'm ever have the good fortune to be on, say, a radio show where I'm actually in debate with a feminist, they're uncomfortable. I do bring up facts and statistics that come from irrefutable sources like Canada's Statistics Canada or Canada's National Clearinghouse on Family Violence. They have no answer to these facts and statistics. So as a result, I am very rarely asked to debate on our national news, the Canadian Broadcasting System, Corporation, almost never asks me to come on and speak, although many talk shows like your own or just talk shows where a variety of subjects are talked about often do ask me to come on. So that tells me that this is a subject that really is almost taboo, and people really are afraid to get into it in an honest and objective way.
Yes, we're speaking with Barbara Kay, columnist for the National Post newspaper in Canada. And Barbara, I think for that reason, it's great to have you as a woman addressing these issues, because I guess people just assume you're going to fall in with the feminist camp.
Well, it is true that most women journalists do have a feminist bent, and it's also true that men who do, I think a lot of male journalists in various media absolutely know the truth, but they also know that for them as men to be the people who are bringing these facts to public attention is not good for their careers. I mean, I'm not joking. I think the few men who are brave enough to bring up the subject have found that they sort of meet such a wall of resistance and hostility that it really isn't worth it, and they've kind of retreated from the subject. So really, if women do not discuss this topic, it's not going to be talked about. That's kind of frightening, isn't it?
It is, but I think that's another aspect that I hadn't really considered. But, I think men are always going to be reticent to report domestic violence against themselves because they're assumed to be bigger and stronger and whatever. And I've heard of men going to police stations and being laughed at by the police when they raise these sort of issues. So it's really, you know, until we get some momentum going, it's going to be very difficult to do anything about this situation.
No, I think I don't want to be entirely depressing.
Never.
I actually see a kind of change in the general situation. I do see more receptivity in amongst ordinary people, to they're curious about the subject. We're seeing the abortion debate brought up in Canada in a new way. People are getting angry about the way boys are dropping out of school, or they are in the minority on campuses, and nobody seems to care. And I am beginning to see more articles in scholarly journals about the subject, and in fact, a new journal in Canada was just started. It's called New Male Studies. And it's very encouraging, I think, that a journal like this can be started with all kinds of articles that can be easily accessed online. The other optimistic development, I think, is that several male studies courses are being established. You have somebody in Australia who I'm sure you must have interviewed, Miles Groff.
Yes.
You know him?
Yes, we have had Miles on the program.
Well, he's one of the editors of this new journal. He has a very fine article in it discussing the beginning and development of male studies courses and why there is a need for them. I find this a positive development. I think that this will have a trickle-down effect into the culture.
Yes, well, I mentioned a bit earlier in the program, but there's a bit of a ruckus going among the feminists in Australia at the moment because one of the old-school feminists, a woman called Anne Summers, has recently pronounced that any woman that doesn't believe in abortion on demand cannot really be a feminist. And so this has brought out all sorts of people saying, you know, I'll decide what I want to be and what I want to do, and you know, I'm not going to be dictated to by someone like you, Anne Summers.
You see, this is very old school feminism. Hmm. She doesn't perhaps think she's old school, but this is the radical feminists from the 80s and 90s who think that there's only one way, you know, just like there's only one way to be a Marxist, but there's all kinds of feminists, and if you actually Google around for conservative feminists, you'll find groups, Feminists for Life and iFeminists. So there are other smaller movements. There's even a group called Islamic Feminists who are family-friendly and who want to get away from you know, some of the more retrograde cultural elements in their countries of origin, and they want to do away with, of course, this whole honor killing business and all that. But they also don't want to be feminists like the lady you just mentioned, who's, you know, you must believe this or you're not a feminist. Mm. They believe very strongly that a woman is happiest when she collaborates with a man, when she has a happy marriage, when she is a loving wife and a loving mother. I mean, all these things are not incompatible with being a fully independent woman. And socially conservative feminists, I think, are the real feminists because they stand up for their sisters in other cultures, which, by the way, your person in Australia there doesn't bother doing because, you know, that's not her problem. And she thinks other cultures have their own way of doing things, and it's not her issue, but she's wrong. You know, women in trouble in other places absolutely need our encouragement.
Yes, well, there's some positive things, but I suppose I'm also concerned, I think you put in your article, that with young women and violence, that it seems the younger the sample, the more violent the women are relative to men. And we see
that's very concerning. And certainly this is not the first time I've seen that statistic, or I've seen other studies that do bring this up. On college campuses, for example, there seems to be, across the board, more sort of minor to moderate level of violence directed against males than males to females. So I think a lot of this, boosting of women's confidence and self-esteem is great, but if it's starting to make them feel that they can adopt the worst behaviors of sexism, that's a very bad thing, and I think it's a subject that is not addressed at all, or hardly ever.
Yes, well, it's anecdotal, I suppose, in Australia, but we often have police officers being interviewed and newspaper articles, and it's the young women who are going out on drunken binges and getting into trouble with the police on Friday and Saturday night and causing all sorts of problems in the community. If anything, it seems to be more than the young men, if that's possible, but it really is becoming a problem.
I think it is a problem. I think self-esteem is a good thing, but to be taught that you're always, whatever you do is fine, or that you never do anything wrong, only the other sex does things that are wrong, this can lead to a sense of entitlement that is extremely unhealthy. I would hope that we're moving more towards a collaborative ideal. And I think what's happening here, Bill, is that we have a kind of split. In Western culture, we have a kind of split between those who are educated, who understand what people need in life to get ahead, and the people that are less educated and more gullible. For example, you have the educated people, women who are educated. They don't have babies as single mothers. They wait to get married. They marry later than they used to, but they stay married, and they do appreciate that children need fathers. And only, I think, something like 6% of them have children before marriage. But then you have all the other people that were, they sort of got the trickle-down effect of feminism, saying that men weren't necessary. You still have this terrible problem of unwed mothers, children without fathers. It seems to be almost like there's two different cultures going on, because the feminists themselves come from the cultural elites of they're very educated, and their own lives, they lead quite entitled lives. But they're preaching to an entire culture, and that culture has taken them at their word, and the culture is in decline socially. But the people that are saving themselves, they're in the lifeboats, are the educated people. So they don't see a problem. Do you see what I mean? They call themselves feminists, but in fact, they're leading traditional lives in many ways. The women work, but they also have husbands, and, they hang on to them.
Yes, and I think you've written elsewhere that you're a great supporter for marriage and for women wanting to get into that situation as being the best way to raise children.
Well, it is. I mean, we know this. This is not news. This is something that has been proven over and over again, that marriage lends commitment and stability to a relationship, and that people in a committed relationship are better parents. They have more long-lasting relationships, and children are safer and more secure and more confident in those situations. So I do not believe in hookups and endless serial relationships. I think this leads to a kind of deadening of your ability to have a meaningful, intimate relationship. And I'm not saying people should get married at the age of 20 like they did in my day, but they shouldn't be waiting till they're 40 either. This is not a good thing. I do believe marriage is still the only institution that really gives kids the best chance in life. I'm not happy with our divorce laws. I'm not happy with our custody laws. But I still think marriage is our only hope as a society.
On that note, we're speaking with Barbara Kay, columnist for the National Post newspaper in Canada, and Barbara has been kind enough to select some music to go with our interview. And so, Barbara, I wonder if you could tell us what you've picked and why you've picked it.
Well, you'll probably laugh at me. The song I picked is Beyoncé's All the Single Ladies. And the reason I chose it is, one, it makes me feel like dancing. I think it's very addictive. Once you hear it, it's in your mind for the rest of the day. It's very, it's a very fun song, but it has a very good message. In spite of the fact that Beyoncé is a very sexy, beautiful lady, and she's, very confident and very, liberated type of young woman, this song has a message. The song is, I don't want to be a sexual object. I don't want to be exploited because you want me just, to go to bed with me. If you like it, put a ring on it. In other words, if you like me, I want commitment. I want to be married, and I want to know that I'm loved and not just lusted after. And in spite of its very peppy and upbeat, rhythms and tune, it's got a serious message at the bottom of it.
Well, look, we can hardly wait. We're going to start dancing around the studio. But Barbara, thank you very much for coming on the program. It's always a delight to talk to you. And
thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy this. I really enjoy Hands Across the Ocean.
That's great. So we'll put the song on, and thank you again, and we'll have to talk again soon, Barbara.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air for the last time, this 31st day of January 2012. And we'd like to thank our special guests for being on the program today. We had Kyle Lovett, research editor and author at A Voice for Men. Kyle is a dedicated researcher and blogger, and we thank him very much for being on the program. If you get more details of Kyle, go to our website. And just reminding you again, that is www.dadsontheair.com.au. We also had Barbara Kay, columnist for the National Post newspaper in Canada. So it was great to have those people on the show today, and I can hear the music starting up. So, yeah, what have we got for next
week?
That's
it for another week. Well, next week we're having a program on babies, and well, the theme is babies and toddlers need their fathers. We'll be having Kingsley Miller from Even Toddlers in the United Kingdom and Gil Ronan from the Coalition for Children and the Family in Israel. So next week should be an interesting show. We'll be back next week.
With that.